Hello and welcome to this discussing episode, recording live on the internet with an audience that no one can hear, but they are out there, scientists assure me. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, and today we're talking about Thomas Middleton and more specifically about a book about Thomas Middleton, a collection of essays, The Theatrical Legacy of Thomas Middleton, 1624 to 2024, which has been released this month. The editors of that volume are with me now to discuss the work and Middleton generally as we approach the anniversary of his last stage work, A Game at Chess. But before we get to all of that, my guests, who are you? And if you could ask Middleton anything, any question at all, what would it be?
Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Anna Hegland. I did my graduate work in the UK at the University of Kent and the University of Birmingham, but I'm now back in the United States. And I work at Carthage College, which is a small private liberal arts university just north of Chicago. I worked on Middleton as part of my PhD thesis, and I'm excited to have this opportunity to talk about him in more detail here, a playwright that I think everyone should be talking more about. And the question that I would ask Middleton is, what play would you have written after Game at Chess?
Oh, that's a good one. I like that. Let's try and guess an answer to that as we go along. Next up is...
Hello, my name is Sam Jeremy. I got my PhD from the University in Leeds in 2022, and I was interested in masculinities and how they're problematic, awful, exciting, wonderful, and bloody in Middleton's work. And I've also conducted a series of stuff with the International Anthony Burgess Foundation on early modern literature, and I'm now a freelance Middleton enthusiast. And if I had one question that I would ask Middleton, it would be, who have you collaborated with that we don't know about yet? Because the list seems endless, but I think it could be even longer.
Mm. And our final panelist is...
Hello, I'm Dr. Will Green. I'm a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Nottingham. I did my PhD on Middleton at the University of Birmingham Shakespeare Institute, and I'm currently very interested in Middleton's political works, particularly during the 1620s, around the time of the outbreak of the 30 Years' War. And if I was going to ask Middleton any question, I'd want to ask him something along the lines of, did you never worry that you were really going to land yourself in hot water because your collection Microcynicon was publicly burned when you were 19, and then you carried on writing The Roaring Girl, The Witch, A Game at Chess? What made you so brave?
Yes. So for the listeners at home, a little context, because we've just assumed everyone knows who Thomas Middleton is. I mean, he's a playwright, writing the early 17th century. He's pretty much a Jacobean playwright in the sense that that's pretty much where all his work lives in the reign of King James. His work has survived in piecemeal fashion until relatively recently, which that is a talking point we'll come to in a moment. But I think we've all encountered different plays by Middleton in different ways, sometimes under the aegis of different authors. And it's always an interesting question to ask all of the panel all at once or one at a time. How do you come to, you know, connect with Middleton? What drew you to him? What was so interesting about Middleton's writing? But, you know, what drew you to him? Anna?
So I first encountered Middleton in my undergraduate degree as part of my kind of senior seminar in my fourth year at university. The focus of the seminar was on the 1590s in London, and it extended into the early 1600s. But we encountered some Middleton as part of that class. And I had never, ever heard of or read any Middleton before. And I was so captivated by The Revenger's Tragedy, which I think is many people's first encounter. It's so spectacularly bloody, and it's just a lot of fun. And I've now, you know, seen that play several times in performance, and it just kind of, every time I return to it, it's just so fun. But that was my kind of entrance into Middleton. And as soon as I read that play, I knew that I wanted to do more with Middleton, but I didn't know how I would have the opportunity. And then during my master's degree, I took a class on Middleton and Johnson. And so that was my kind of opportunity to dive deeper into these two other huge names in 17th century drama. And I just had a great time, and I kept coming back to Middleton during my PhD.
I think for a lot of people, Revenge is Tragedy is going to be the route in, even if they think it's by a chap called Cyril. Any other routes in, Sam?
I think my maybe one of the few routes where the Revenge is Tragedy wasn't the first thing I encountered. It was during my undergraduate at the University of Exeter, and we're doing a module about the life and death in early modern literature, all about the life cycle and how normal lives are supposed to be lived. And A Chaste Maiden Cheapside was on that list. And it felt something so strange and like gutturally like unwholesome that it was so appealing. Mutton as children, children as mutton, and like indescribable liquids passing across the stage, fake death, surprise marriage. And it's just like, this is bonkers. I've always come to him more from the comedy, and then I looked more at the other comedies he's written, and oh yes, there's lots going on there, and it just kept me going. And then eventually it came around to the tragedies as well, and they're just as delightfully strange, really.
I like a bit of delight in strangeness and unsavory elements. I'm quite fond of some unsavory elements. Will, did you have a play that drew you in?
Well, yes, and Anna's probably predicted this, because it was The Revenge of Tragedy, but not by Cyril, it was by Tom when I read it. And that was during my undergraduate studies at the University of Winchester, doing a module, a bit of a misnomer, it was a module on Elizabethan drama. Of course, The Revenge of Tragedy is Jacobean. But what I found most interesting was, because I was very interested in a lot of the writers of the time. We'd done Marlowe, we'd done Kidd, Johnson. When we got onto Middleton, there's something about that play that made it just feel a lot wittier. Not in terms of sort of the comedy that was being put into it, but it was that ending that really spoke to me when, for those who don't know, main characters help to murder a duke and tell someone who has been wronged by that duke that they are now the duke. And he then has those people who committed murder for him taken away to execution, because you that did murder him would murder me. And there was something that was so true about that cycle of tyranny and power and corruption that really just made me think, I want to know more about this guy. And then the more I read, the more fascinating I thought his works were.
So this has led you to write, edit a collection of essays about Thomas Middleton. So how did this project come about, and why did it happen now? Who wants to leap in and grab the how, as it were?
I think I should probably start with the how, because I just finished my PhD, and in that early career, trying to find publication opportunities, thinking of something interesting to do. And it struck me that, well, this was in 2021. So I thought 2024 isn't that far away. A Game of Chess is going to have this 400th anniversary. It's such a significant play. My initial thought was, is anyone doing anything? Is anyone publishing anything that will celebrate the anniversary of this play? So I posted on Twitter, you know, back when it was good, before it became X, are there any other early career researchers who are interested in working on me on putting something together? We didn't have an idea that was set in stone, just celebrating the anniversary of the Game of Chess. There was a lot of interest. Sam and Anna were two of the people who responded to that tweet. I think then it just very quickly dawned on us that there would be a lot of interest in this, based on the amount of people who responded to that initial tweet. So really, that's how the project got off the ground. We found, you know, Routledge was very interested. A lot of people were interested in sending us abstracts. So we realized this was actually, there was a lot of interest out there. And this would be something that, you know, we really thought would have legs.
Yes, Anna.
I remember when we first sat down to kind of go through, here are the abstracts that we've kind of collected that we think would make a volume that is a cohesive whole. And we put everything down and we kind of decided on a potential order for the book proposal. And we all kind of looked at each other on Zoom, because we've always been doing this across two different, very vastly different time zones. We looked at each other, we went, oh my God, we've got a book. And we had this moment of realizing just how big this could be. I mean, Will said, like, we had a lot of interest. He got a lot of interest on Twitter. And then we had a lot of interest in terms of people expressing interest in a proposal, as in publishing houses, but then also people submitting inquiries about having a potential chapter, and just realizing how important this could be and how necessary it was.
and just drawing on the question of why now, you mentioned we're coming to this anniversary of A Game at Chess, which is Middleton's last public stage work, and we're celebrating that at the moment ourselves, working towards our own sort of logic for that. People love an anniversary, and in a sense, it's almost the end of his career. Even though he won't die for another couple of years, it is almost the end of his career. And so the book is focusing on Middleton's legacy, his theatrical legacy, what comes after all these works are done. So where is your focus within? Because obviously Middleton wrote quite a lot. Is there a reason why you're focusing on drama and performance? Anna?
Yeah, I can start, but I think Sam and Will have some good things to add here. I think some of it came from our own research. The fact that all three of us, you know, started from a place where drama and performance were kind of central to the research we were doing. And then it stems off from there and goes in other places. And I think that happens in the volume as well. But I think some of this comes from our own experiences and our own encounters with Middleton, starting from that place of thinking about performance in some way or another.
Sam?
There's also that aspect of Middleton, which we think about performance and drama. We don't think about that isn't confined just to plays. And I think it is important that we think about Middleton in terms of he's writing Lord Mayor's shows, he's doing civic entertainments and all of this pageantry alongside it. And it's a specific genre, even though it captures part of this theatricality and staginess that we think about with Middleton. And even though it's not the overriding focus on the volume, we have some great contributions thinking about Middleton's civic drama. And I think that is an important aspect to what he is, that Middleton's very stagey, and it's hard not to get drawn into that aspect of it as well.
Yeah, we were careful to, I think, focus on the theatre as the term rather than just plays, because we want to think of really what's being performed. So civic entertainments falls into that. If we're focusing on the whole of Middleton, it could get a bit messy, because then, what is the legacy of Plato's Cap, for example, or News from Gravesend? But plays and civic entertainments, there's so much of a rich history that goes with them. Just that genre lends itself so well to performance and having a legacy.
Part of that legacy is, of course, a few years ago, an attempt was made to sort of figure out how wide Middleton's canon was and make some decisions about that. And we ended up with a collected works of Thomas Middleton. And I think across the academic world, this has been a great boon for people after the beginning of the pandemic, when everyone needed something to put their laptops on to raise them up a little bit. Because for those who don't know, the collected works of Thomas Middleton is the definition of a doorstop. It is absolutely enormous. That comes with an element of controversy in terms of deciding what is by Thomas Middleton and what is Middleton as a canon. And I'm trying to phrase this question very carefully for Will. What is it about Middleton that is definably different from other playwrights? What is the most Middletoniness of Middleton in his works?
Yeah. Middleton, as a unique dramatist, I think he's a lot more grubby than others. And I don't mean that in an insulting way. I think he does it in a very clever way. He's not someone who is interested in saying, this romantic story, there's some discord in it, we're going to bring in Jupiter onto stage or some other mythical figure to sort it out. He's someone who will write about the human experience in a very realistic way. He's happy to give people drama that will talk about money, and we'll talk about selfishness, and we'll talk about greed and drunkenness and sexual deviancy, desire, criminality, all these different aspects of society Middleton is happy to talk about. And it does mean a lot of his plays can be very grim, quite violent, but they're also so clever. So his artistry, it just feels, when I say it, he's more grubby, his artistry just feels so much more real. And I think that speaks to us as a society a lot better than, say, John Fletcher. Just my opinion. Sorry for anyone's a huge Fletcher fan. in our audience.
We are a broad church. We are here for almost everybody from the period. Down and dirty, the grubbiness of his world. Other thoughts from the contributors on that. What is Middleton to you, perhaps? Sam.
I think it sort of follows on from Will's idea of this grubbiness. I think it's this sort of really sort of sustained irony that's through his work. Like it's holding these contradictions. I'm not even going to say together. It just holds contradictions so close that these two ideas never fully comprehend. And I think there's something quite real about that. Like it's not, doesn't, or when it does, or even if Middleton's work does become quite tropey and stagey, there's always that sort of, I don't want to say wink, wink, nudge, nudge, but it's not always like that. But it's that sort of, I think it's the quote from The World Tossed at Tennis, that with one eye looks two ways at once. It's that doubleness that's quite interesting. And it feels very real and exciting because it's, things are either not what they seem or they are what they seem. And that's sort of the joke. And it pulls things back a bit. So you can see the bones of how it's constructed as well. So there's all these layers, but you see them all at the same time. I think that's really fascinating.
Anna?
I think the other thing is, and this pulls off of both what Will and Sam have both said, I think Middleton's unafraid to just let the shameful exist out in the open. There is no shame or embarrassment to some of this. Some of the characters may feel that, but the plays themselves, as Sam said, just lay everything bare. And I think that's kind of unique and very special, and something that lends itself to performance if the performers are brave enough to do it. It does take a lot of bravery. Mm. But that kind of unabashedness about being cringy in a way.
Here and beyond, we're primarily led by, you know, the performance angle. You know, what are you going to get on your feet? What are you going to put out there? But of course, this question about, you know, who Middleton is and what his works are do affect that, and also affect how we market him. You know, how do you sell Middleton as opposed to other people? And various questions about, you know, what he wrote, does that get in the way? Does sometimes the minutiae of our discussions about him get in the way of just enjoying the plays, regardless of who they might be by? Does it matter which plays are by him? I'll go to Anna.
I think one of the things that I found while doing my PhD, which was equally text-based and practice-based, I talked a lot with some theater practitioners, and the kind of common theme was selling tickets. And what we can put on a commercial stage today is determined by an audience's familiarity with that playwright. And so what the modern commercial theater has decided is canonical is what will be performed. And that kind of edges out academic interests or more niche interests, because there's a concern about not being able to fill seats. But I think one of the things, and this kind of skips around with some of the things that we've talked about, Rob, and that Will and Sam and I have talked about, is Middleton is inherently performable and is successful in performance. And his plays draw audiences if we give them a chance to. So I think, you know, in a way, it doesn't matter. But thinking about what will sell is the thing that we get distracted by quite a bit, I think.
Yes, I think from our point of view, is effectively nothing actually sells. I don't actually believe that there is really, for most people out there, a canon anymore. There is a very, very small selection of plays that people have actually heard of from our period, and most of them are not by our authors. And so in a sense, we're herring down the wrong path about worrying about whether a game at chess is more marketable than the Revenge's tragedy, because I'd argue that the cachet isn't even that much for a lot of people today, even for a play that many people in this room will probably know very well, like Revenge's tragedy. But actually, if you ask the person on the street, would they have that? And that's partly our job here, is to try and just gather enthusiasm for texts, regardless of that question, and find routes for marketing that people might be interested in that are not the obvious ones that probably won't work. Yes, other thoughts before I go on to other lines of thinking. Will.
Yeah, on the question of whether this authorship issue matters, I think it matters more to some people than others, but it also depends on the play we're talking about. So the Revengers tragedy for years was thought to be Cyril Tourneur, and it was still a known play. I don't know whether the Middleton attribution has necessarily had a huge impact on the appreciation of that play. People might disagree with me on that. But then you get plays, and there's a chapter in our collection on The Bloody Banquet, which, if that's attributed to Dekker and Middleton, it's in the collected works of Middleton. More people are going to read that than if it's languishing in a quarto just attributed to TD. So in that sense, authorship does have a big impact on the circulation of these works, not just in performance, but also among readers. It makes them things that people might notice more and then consider the performability of them. So in a sense, these plays are great, regardless of who worked on them. Mm. But if you can attach the name Middleton to them convincingly, that probably does have a big impact on the promotion of those works, or raising the work, the status of those works in public perception.
Yes, I mean, for all my joshing about the collected works, it does mean that if I am working on any play that is vaguely attributed to Thomas Middleton, I know where to find it. It's over there. It's in a big volume. Whereas, actually, a lot of the plays we're talking about are actually quite difficult to find in individual editions, scholarly or otherwise, and the collections are really good starting points and good routes in for people to find ways of making things happen. We've gone through, I think, the text angle, the starting point of the book. The book moves into areas of performance and the question about performing Middleton today. What do we think the big challenges for performing Middleton are today? I mean, let's set aside. We know it's difficult selling seats. What are the big things? Because Middleton deals with some dark themes, which makes him, in a sense, very up to date and very very much in tune with our times. But also, that can be a challenge as well in terms of how to do it. So, who would like to leap in on that question about challenges for Middleton today? What do we think?
I can take this. Having edited the performance section, I think I probably should start. But I do want to hear what Will and Sam have to say as well. I think for me, it comes back to that issue that we've already talked about of what makes Middleton Middleton. Of some of this is quite, you know, as you said, kind of gritty and dark, and that takes a lot of bravery as a performer. One of the hardest things as an actor is to be okay with being disliked. I think there's some profoundly unlikable characters in Middleton who are quite fun to perform, but also quite a challenge for an actor and for a company to kind of lean into that unlikable kind of character type and have fun with it and not be ashamed of it again. So taking a step as a performer to put yourself out there to be openly disliked by an audience is a very vulnerable thing and very difficult. And I think for me, having considered my own encounters with Middleton in performance, that is a particular challenge that I think of quite a lot.
Sam?
I think another challenge is almost this preconception of what Middleton should be, because I think when people think of Middleton, it's the Revengers tragedy or Women Beware Women and these sort of very dark, excessive, horrid, think like bloody laughter sort of tragedies. But it's some of the issues with that then come with that people don't want to explore just how funny it is to hear Middleton in performance. He really sort of gets this like tat-a-tat of people talking to each other on stage and having this quick repartee. So I think part of it is almost people think of Middleton in a certain way, but because he's written so much, there's not really a way around it. He's written so many different kinds of things. There's so many different ways you can approach Middleton. And in some ways that's daunting, but I think there's a real like pleasure in these sort of, he really understands genre and what makes a genre work in performance. So it's almost the challenge is to get someone to see that first one and they're like, oh, what else has he written? And then you can turn it around and be like, oh, you love that comedy? Here's some revenge tragedy.
And also sometimes it's interesting. I was talking to someone the other day when working towards a game at chess of going, oh, I'm, you know, I've got a poster design. It's going to be a chessboard. You know, it all feels a bit obvious. You know, what should we do? And they were saying, oh, I've always seen it. It should be a chessboard and sort of blood everywhere. And I'm going, well, I think technically a game at chess is a comedy. I mean, it does have extreme you know, there is threats of sexual violence throughout it, and that there are lots of very dark passages. But technically, I don't think any that's quite the image that the play actually should exude. But it's interesting that that's almost the immediate go-to thought that someone might have with a play like that. Well,
yeah, it's kind of builds off what's already been said, but I think another thing that might worry people about staging Middleton is the honesty, because Middleton is very, I mean, Ben Jonson called Thomas Middleton a base fellow, and I whatever we interpret that to mean, he's just such an honest person, and there might be the fear that if you go to see a Middleton play, he's happy to tell you that we're all hypocrites to some extent. You're probably going to see yourself made fun of at some point in a Middleton play. There's a lot in Middleton that can be very uncomfortable, I think, to a lot of people who might not see themselves in that sort of base side of existence.
Thought I'd throw a question directly at Sam. In terms of you know, we've been talking about the kinds of performances that we're looking at today, and you have an essay on masculinity on Middleton's stage. What sort of things is he playing with that just send us in a slightly different direction?
There's a real this idea of being sort of harping on about this laid bareness of masculinity. Like, no one is safe in what they think their masculinity is. You have beards being passed around on stage like they're nothing, whereas these supposed to be these very masculine things, but people just throw them around or say, I'm wearing a beard, and then people know it's fake. And this sort of materiality of masculinity, it's sort of assembled, cobbled together. And as we've seen, a lot of Middleton is used to disguise. People are always throwing new cloaks on, new disguises. It passes around so fast. And I think there's a real disinterest in thinking anything stable. I think that's really interesting for masculinity, and especially in the early modern period, where it's always establishing itself, and Middleton is always picking it apart and seeing these pieces that bring gender into being, which is, I think, it's really fascinating.
A thought that's occurring based on the various comments we were making about, you know, how Middleton hits an audience, how we react to Middleton. I think perhaps it helps that actually the lack of knowledge that people sometimes have of the wider canon is that, you know, Middleton can surprise us. I mean, there are a few of Middleton plays I've seen several times, but there aren't many. And even if I've read them or workshopped them, they can still surprise me of going, oh my, the impact of that I wasn't expecting. So is there an advantage Middleton has over some other playwrights that he's not only subverting expectations in what he's doing, but also that we have an automatic sort of Christian of things surprises, A, because they're surprising, but also because we don't really know what to expect? That was the worst kind of question, because it wasn't a question. It's the kind of thing we berate audiences for doing. That was more of, this is more of a statement than a question. Yeah. anyone got anything on that? Otherwise, I will go on to something else.
I'll just say I concur. Mm.
Oh, I love being right. It's so much fun. I was going to say we should now talk about civic. This is the slightly awkward part of the discussion, because we talked about plays and it's sort of, let's talk about civic pageantry. But I'm also very aware that we as a podcast produce quite a lot of civic pageantry. In fact, for those interested in buying the book, I'm maybe about to put you off, because I happen to be in the book. I don't know what I said when I was interviewed to be in the book, because we reconstructed the 1621 Lord Mayor's show a few years ago with Professor Tracy Hill. And so we've engaged with what Middleton was doing, not only on a public stage, but also on a even more public stage where you didn't have to pay for access. So Anna, when you were interviewing me, how incoherent was I?
You were very coherent. I think I, when I kind of pulled the transcript from Zoom of our conversation, it was about 12, 13 pages, single-spaced, of us kind of rambling at each other. But as I read through afterwards, there were common threads that came through. So it was relatively easy to edit for a book chapter, though there were things that I was like, oh, I wish I could include this, because it was so fun to kind of, you know, think very broadly together. But that just means there's room to publish more. So, but I really enjoyed that conversation and thinking about, you know, your experience, having only encountered that civic pageant and your performance of it through, well, not to have only encountered the civic pageant, but encountered your performance of it through video and YouTube, hearing about your experience of it happening live was really fascinating for me to think about the kind of practical side of the things that I was thinking about from a very removed kind of scholarly level. To think about, you know, the things that you were saying about the logistics of hearing what the actors were saying and how in the rain, outdoors, with traffic noise going by, do we hear what these actors are saying? And do we make a coherent production, especially given that we're standing in one place and we're kind of limited in terms of place and space when this pageant traveled? And so audiences would have heard only the bits that they were in front of, to then moving it to a kind of stationary audience space. I really enjoyed hearing about all that kind of from a firsthand perspective. So that was really, really fun for me. It was very coherent.
Yeah, it's interesting with Middleton as a writer writing for, you know, a very public event, and he can't help making comments even there. I mean, he can't help just push the edges of what is a good idea to say. It seems to be that runs through a couple of his Lord Mayor shows. I was talking to Tracy Hill about this only the other day. We were talking about a speech from 1623 where it's not clear whether it was actually performed or not, or whether it was quietly removed and it just ended up in the printed version, because it's not necessarily politically a very wise speech to be making at the time. And is it that he just can't help himself, or is he very politically aware in the way we would say today, as someone who might be of a you know, the left or the right, who is deliberately pushing an agenda, or is it just he can't help himself?
Well, I think, not to turn this away from Middleton for a second, but this is one of the things that I appreciated about Caitlin Finlayson's chapter, which looked at kind of legacies and adaptations of civic pageantry and how they've changed and been used throughout the years, and some kind of modern adaptations of Middleton pageantry, Middletonian pageantry, and what has been kind of elided or collapsed or combined with other works to create the kind of political vision of London and London society that each kind of period wanted for itself. And so that kind of immediacy through intervention is one of the things that I really like about that chapter, thinking about how, yeah, Middleton might have been saying more than he should have, and maybe not all of it would have been performed, but what are we saying in the 80s that may or may not be pushing the boundaries then?
Now, we've done a lot of love fest for Middleton here. I think we should just put our critical hats on for a while, because you know, there are problems sometimes with plays. There are plays where there are inherent questions about, you know, precisely what's happened to the text as it's come to us. But there's one thing, and with Beyond, we do online play readings, and we haven't done too much Middleton yet. For those who are listening to this on the podcast, you can always sign up and join us as we read through plays. We do several sessions a week, and anyone can join us. And we are now sort of really getting into quite, you know, Middleton's cropping up more and more as we're working our way through the early 1600s. But one narrative quirk, and I'm really interested in this, I don't know how frequently he uses this, but it's cropped up a few times, is a scene will happen and you don't know quite what's going on. Someone might explain obliquely what's going on, but then it will be the scene after, or the scene after that, that someone will explicitly say, oh yeah, that thing was going on because of this and this and this. And it's like he throws things at an audience. And when you're reading a play, this often throws us quite a lot, because it's like, I don't know what's going on, and we don't have as many signifiers because we're just reading a script. Is this question about what he's doing there, is it an effective way of writing, or is it just a quirk that he's got into, and it's actually quite annoying? I'm throwing it out there that might not be a good thing. It might actually be a bad thing in the way he writes. Any other things that people might have noticed in Tom that they worry about? Are you worried about Tom? See, these aren't part of the prepared questions. I'm just making this up as I'm going along, and therefore everyone's really scared. Will?
I mean, today, if you're writing an article for a newspaper, the headline is prepared by someone else. You might not necessarily have had much say in how clickbaity that is. I think a lot of Middleton's plays, I sometimes wonder, is there a complete disconnect between what he's written and who decides on the title? Because you'll get works like The Bloody Banquet. Well, The Bloody Banquet of the title does not even get hinted at until you've sat through a lot of the play. There's a lot of violence going on, a lot of intrigue and corruption and humour and things that just make you unnerved. But The Bloody Banquet, that is just something that's being suggested for a long time. Then you get other plays like that have gone down history with titles like The Puritan Widow, which is just completely wrong, because the Puritan in that play is not the widow. That's very confusing. And then you'll get plays like the play that the Oxford Middleton calls The Lady's Tragedy, which just has no title. So there's a lot going on there, that these titles don't always match the content of the plays, or they're suggesting it's something, but you might not be sure when that's happening or what's happening in that. That can, I think, sometimes be a barrier, because if you don't know that, you maybe might start getting a bit confused about what's actually going on in these works.
Yes, I mean, the collection does discuss The Bloody Banquet, and is there an element there that you should make sure that is a show without an interval? Because if they've hit the interval and they haven't seen any sign of a bloody banquet, you know, would you lose people at that moment? Do you need to signpost it? And yeah, that question about titles. I mean, we have other plays by other playwrights bobbing about, where clearly the B plot has been considered a lot more important than the A plot for audiences, because the clown's done something hilarious. You know, Blurt Master Constable is not a play that features much blurt, and yet somehow that is the title that comes primarily down to us. And there are lots of examples like that where, yeah, the author probably hasn't necessarily intended that to be the title for the first, after the first performance. Anna?
I do want to jump in and say we have a really brilliant chapter by Charlene Smith, who's in the audience today, and Claire Kimball, that talks about The Bloody Banquet in performance, and it is fantastic, and I love it, and includes an image of a jello skull and brain. So for that alone, but you should buy it just for that. So, but it's a really good discussion of The Bloody Banquet, because there are some points where you do question how it functions in performance. And I think Charlene and Claire did a really good job of kind of picking that apart and thinking about their experience directing and as dramaturg of that production.
Any other elements of the book that you really want to highlight at this point as we're approaching the end of the official part of this programme? Will?
I just think we should take this time to say that everything that's been written and published in this volume is fantastic, and the work the contributors put into it is something that we are so pleased with, because you know, this was our first endeavour putting a book like this together. It was difficult work. But what our contributors produced, I mean, you've got Dan's chapter in chapter two, which the amount of work that must have gone into analysing all of these different manuscripts of A Game of Chess that you looked at, that's incredible. We've got people who have really laboured to get a chapter done through personal difficulties, through finishing a PhD. There's just so much that was put into this volume that if we want to highlight something that's great about it, it's what our contributors produced. Mm.
Within what they produced, there is obviously an index that features such responses as Batman and Harry Styles. Do they link you to the same page or to different sections? Anyone would like to leap in? Sam?
It is in the same section, because quite a lot of people wanted to think about what's resonating with Middleton today with us and what I'm concerned with and with our current critical, like how are we thinking about the early modern world, how are we thinking about Middleton? And it's things like revenge, capitalism, gender, questions of gender, questions of how things are staged. And it just goes to show that if we can put Harry Styles and Middleton, Thomas Middleton, together, you know, something's gone right. I think Middleton clearly is still speaking to us quite strongly, and we're speaking right back and throwing Batman at him.
But which iteration are we talking about? Are we talking 60s Batman, or are we talking late? Because, you know, I quite like to see you know, Middleton walking up a wall sideways. I think that would be fine.
It's the Moody Batman Arkham Knight. It's very, very recent.
Right. Well, who would like to do the official plug for the book? Sam?
Yeah, so the theatrical legacy of Thomas Middleton, 1624 to 2024, is our collected volume of essays that celebrate Middleton's legacy as a dramatist and marks the 400th anniversary of Middleton's final work for the public theatres, A Game at Chess. Much like Middleton's own canon, the collection features a range of wide voices, from early career, independent and seasoned academics to performers and practitioners. We've sort of really tried to have a holistic approach as possible to mirror Middleton's own sort of multifaceted and contradictory sort of canon that exists. And so the collection itself is broadly split into three sections. We think about the fresh critical approaches to Middleton's plays in their original performance and print contexts, how Middleton resonates to our contemporary critical and scholarly interests, and also how Middleton is adapted and appropriated in performance 400 years later. It is published by Routledge only this month, so it's still very fresh, doesn't have its own legacy. And I think the book will be really useful for anyone who wants to think about the early modern world and at Middleton, and wants to think about Middleton's particular significance to early theatre. And we also don't want this collection to be the final say on anything to do with Middleton. So we really hope that people want to engage with the range of perspectives that our contributors have engaged in, and sort of encourage Middleton enthusiasts to think about the variety of legacies that Middleton continues to have. And I think, you know, we can say with confidence, it is the only Middleton book that does talk about A Game of Chess, the early modern Lord Mayor's shows, and Batman in the same book.
And that volume is out now. Links will be in the show description. Those listening in the far future, maybe it's been so successful because of all the people who've bought it following this episode, that in fact there might be even a paperback edition in the far future. Wouldn't that be nice? And a more reasonable volume for everybody to be able to pick up and read at their leisure. And in fact, hopefully more projects to follow. We at Beyond are doing 9 online Zoom readings of A Game at Chess on the anniversary of the 9 performances. Anyone can join and sign up for that. Anyone listening to this session live, as well as those listening to it on the podcast in the future. Sign-up forms are on the website, beyondshakespeare.org. We are also going to be doing a day-long celebration of Thomas Middleton at the end of his career, including a full audio recording of A Game at Chess, as well as the 1626 Lord Mayor's Show, and a selection of other works, and hopefully some panels and additional discussions and things that we're going to be throwing together at the White Bear in Kennington. Tickets are not available yet, but there is a pre-sign-up form available, also in the show description. Anyone can sign up to try and get those tickets early, because they will go out early. They're very strictly limited numbers. We are not selling many tickets, and so there is a certain amount of scarcity. And also, they will be cheaper for those who have signed up in advance. The general price will be slightly more, but precise decisions on that to be made. Before I close the official part of this podcast, any final thoughts from the room? Will, do you have anything final you'd like to say about Thomas Middleton before the opportunity ends forever?
Well, a shocking question to come at the end. What else would I say about Middleton? Go out and experience him. You know, you probably won't be able to find that many of his plays being performed immediately, but they're always worth looking into. There's always something to find. And I always recommend going for something that is less well-known. I think a lot of people looked at the Avengers tragedy. Try A Mad World, My Masters. Try A Trick to Catch the Old One. There's something for everyone. Try Yorkshire Tragedy. That's a good one.
Yes, we almost put that into the lineup for the show, but we decided we didn't quite have time to squeeze it in. Anna, any final thoughts?
I know you've put the pressure on with our last thoughts ever on Middleton. I think, you know, as Will said, go look up more Middleton. Middleton is a playwright worth exploring, and he did so much more beyond just plays. And so I think expand your Middletonian vocabulary, not only in the plays, but also with pageants and other types of entertainments. Because there's a really rich field out there, scholarly and performance. It's really worth diving into. It's very rewarding, and it's fun and challenging. And I think you can learn a lot from Middleton.
Sam, any final thoughts?
Well, it's very selfish, but I personally would like to see a Chase Made in Cheapside put on somewhere. So if we can't get a theatre to do it, I think we should try and get, see if someone can get 30 friends together to play all these little pages and children, and then I'll be happy.
We'll see what we can do. One other thing to say about As It Beyond, we are infinitely bribable. So we are paid for partly by our patrons, patreon.com, and every year patrons get to vote. And I'm not suggesting that people should do this, but obviously if a lot of you got together and decided in advance which Middleton play you wanted to do, you could just vote for it. And, you know, it, you might not get through the first year because there's a lot of ongoing stacked up votes. But if you're persistent within, you know, not too long, you could have the production of your dreams. You just have to get organised, people. I'll stage anything. Just give me the money and I'll make it happen. All that remains after these wanton plugs is thank my wonderful guests for giving up their time and the wonderful live audience who are here and who will be engaging in a question and answer section at now. So all that remains to thank all our wonderful participants. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye.